is the day-long on attention and mindfulness. And I just wanted to start by saying I think it's really important as a practitioner when looking at the Dharma to really constantly make this an exploration and not allow the mind to solidify things and to reify them, because the ultimate experience is that we are that we're seeking in the most positive sense of that term, and the ultimate experience is, at least traditionally, that define the liberation of the mind, that actually liberate the mind and the heart, are experiences which are beyond concepts and language. So, you know, just in terms of the go-around, when we began, you know, we've got at least people who are practicing in three separate traditions, and then within the traditions, there's a wide variance of what's emphasized and what's de-emphasized. And so it's important to, you know, listen to your own experience and what you're learning from your own experience. This is part of the reason I think reflection is so important, because sometimes it's easy to just be practicing, and it's like, well, I'm just practicing, and I'm never actually reflecting on, well, what is the experience that I'm having, and what is the result of the particular way that I'm practicing, because these different strategies and techniques, whatever you want to call them, produce different experiences. And you have to find those that resonate with where you are on the path at a particular moment and with your particular history and your personality type, and see what happens. So, you know, on the one side, you know, just making it dualistic, on the one side, there's emphasis on practice, where you're practicing so much that you begin having relatively deep experiences, but you don't have a framework for holding them. And although this is slightly different, I think it's the same point, that one of my favorite interviews that I saw of the Dalai Lama was the interviewer is kind of going through this catalog of questions about meditation and comparing it to other things, and gets to the issue of psychedelic drugs, and says to the Dalai Lama, it's kind of a setup. You can see where the interviewer wants to go with this. He wants the Dalai Lama, and assumes that the Dalai Lama is going to make a pejorative statement about psychedelic drugs and the experience on psychedelic drugs. And so the interviewer kind of asks it that way, with that tone of voice. And the Dalai Lama's response is, actually, many of the experiences that people have on psychedelic drugs are quite important and are quite similar to some of the advanced experiences that you have in meditation. The problem isn't the experience. The problem is because the person has obtained the experience through a quick and easy, basically, chemical process. They haven't gone through the training of the mind, and they haven't gone through the study that creates a framework to hold and understand that experience. So the role of study and practice are both very important. And then over on the other side, to make it dualistic, you can study so much, and frankly, I think this is a little bit of the problem of Western practitioners. I mean, I can't believe the flood of books that are constantly coming out. When I first started practicing in the seriously in the early 60s, I couldn't find a good book much less a book on Buddhist practice. But I couldn't find a good book on Hindu meditation, anything, in English that was really clear and used language that was accessible to a Western mind. And, you know, now we have just the reverse. I mean, there's so much, where do you start? And it's become so popular now that what it is starting to become quite blurred, I think. I think, for example, mindfulness is kind of like there's this attitude developing as well, it's in the eye of the beholder. And you have mindfulness being separated from or divorced from its original underpinnings in Buddhist practice. And that's not to say what's left isn't good. It's just to say it's not Buddhist mindfulness. So it's important that we do enough study that we have a framework and understand. And on the other hand, there's a danger of study that there is so much out and there's so much like a really highly technical analysis and evaluation of the suttas that I think it's easy that you can just get lost and be using this as a defense against real experience. It's like you can become so skilled at knowing, you know, all of these layering and all these ideas and how they fit together that you think you actually know the experience. Which what you know is the concept, not the experience. And so I saw an interview with Bhikkhu Bodhi, who I think generally everyone would agree has been has become the primary translator, not necessarily interpreter, but translator of Theravadan work in the last 30 years, this extraordinary output. And in this interview, Bhikkhu Bodhi just comes out and says, well, I think part of the problem with Western practice is that most people's understanding of the Dharma is intellectual and conceptual and not experiential. And I think I would agree with that because most of us are really busy. The amount of time that we can devote to practice, unless we've got, you know, a powerful and kind of sophisticated daily life practice is limited. So unless you're doing, you know, a considerable amount of retreat work and you're working with the teacher and these things, it's very easy to be reading books and what have you and have a conceptual, intellectual understanding and not one that's arising directly out of your own experience, which is the core of this practice. So, with that start, I'd like to go to what our experience was on those reflections, and I'm going to start with the second one first. This idea of, like, well, am I attempting to do walking meditation, or am I busy doing walking meditation, or am I walking and actually receiving the experience that arises from walking? Okay. So. What, and then it's like, well, what did we learn from watching that? So, what happened? What are your thoughts on this? What were your experiences?
I'd never done a walking meditation, so I think at first I was walking and then enjoying the walk, and then I noticed I was walking fast and watched what other people were doing, so I was trying to do what I thought I was supposed to do, and then once I let that go, I was able to just enjoy my walk. So I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do with walking meditation.
All right, so then that's my fault, because I should have asked if there was anybody who hadn't had instruction in it. And that's supposed to be a habit, and I didn't do it, so I apologize. Yeah.
I got stuck the first time we were out trying to do the noting on, like, lifting, moving, placing the foot, and I got caught in this one placing and lifting at the same time with different feet, so I was like kind of obsessing on that, and then when you mentioned that, the next time I went out, I was able to let that go. I realized that I was doing that, I was able to let it go, and just enjoy it more.
Yeah. Yeah, so in the ideal world, the noting is designed to point your mind in. You know, to point, it's an attention, an intentional, attentional attention tool to just keep the mind coming back to the actual experience.
Having done walking meditation for quite some time, the intention has been pretty inculcated that it was an inward activity, that I was not receptive a great deal to the exterior. When I go for walks, I'm very receptive, so I can see the difference a little bit. And so I saw that was the case for me, that it was generated by something that's been somewhat ingrained. So that was the proclivity or tendency, and you know, to open it up. Of course, we're aware. I did find that when I close my eyes, sometimes when I'm standing, the senses become much more receptive than when I'm walking. So in that respect, the connection to the exterior seemed to be received more actively.
Okay. So the notion that because of having practiced for a particular period of time, the mind is inclined in a particular way, right? I mean, this is what actually we're trying to accomplish, right? We're training the mind to behave in a particular way. So like with our attention, we're training our mind to bring it back to what we intend to pay attention to, as opposed to just whatever's happening, right? And we develop bringing it back in a particular way with kindness and without judgment, right? We do all these things. So that's a good thing. Right, if it's consistent with good practice. You know, and of course the problem we've got is we've got so many of these very, very deep habits of mind that aren't healthy, right? That are habits of distraction. Okay. For example, thinking. Well, rather than just staying here in actual experience, my mind wants to think about it or conceptualize it or make a comment about it.
One of the things I discovered, because you planted in us, you know, this, or encouraged this reflection and this watching, is that there would be more of a proliferation of thinking. Okay. And then sometimes what was compelling somewhat is that, you know, because there's, what insights am I going to discover a little bit? And then what can I share that's going to be quite insightful? And then the conceit starts, you know, that the hindrance. It gave me an opportunity to really see a hindrance in all of that, because I wanted to, there was a part of me that wanted to be right or see something unique.
Sure.
It was a very interesting experience.
Introducing the slightest thing can, you know, bring these up, particularly when the idea is that I may have to report on my experience,
yeah.
Right? Then that's a very powerful thing to introduce, right? So, okay. So what else on the idea of that, like, you know, as I was trying to do something, or working hard at it, as opposed to just doing it and receiving the experience?
When I went out there with that in mind, I just kind of paying attention to my experience, and it sort of felt like that if I was really having the experience, it wasn't like I was perceiving it, like the perceiving was coming to me. It was like the experience was just sort of happening. It wasn't like the way it was phrased was, and I was looking at that, it's like, am I doing this because I'm sort of supposed to, or am I actually just receiving the experience? And it was the word receiving, it was like, well, I don't feel like there's a me that's receiving it. I feel like if I was really having it, then there's if the experience is just happening. And I used the word like, well, actually I'm sharing the experience. I'm kind of co-creating the experience.
Yeah.
It's not like there's a me that's perceiving, but it felt kind of dualistic.
Yeah.
In the moments when that fell away, it was just the experience that was just happening.
Yeah. And the sense of effort is completely different between those two experiences, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The one you're describing is relatively effortless.
Mm-hmm.
And the one where you're trying to do walking meditation
right.
actually involves quite a bit of effort.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think I went back and forth between those and probably some other things too.
Yeah. And so, I think it's, if we're lucky, we don't get hung up on language. So whether we're co-creating it or whether we're receiving it and all of these, you know, there's a lot of different ways and languages.
Sure.
Very tricky, and particularly if you're trying to work with the notion of like, well, what does it really mean?
Mm-hmm.
What does a not to mean?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. But this idea that there is a significantly different kind of effort between setting up the conditions so you can just have an experience which is unfolding and receiving it, seeing it, experiencing it, whatever the word is, and putting so much effort into creating the conditions or trying to do it is the idea. And it has to do with over-efforting, right? And then the thing that you have to watch for, because it's always a spectrum, right? You know, like if you think of the Brahma Viharas, kindness or loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, there is the quality of mind or heart or both itself, kindness. And then what is on either end of it, always? There is a near and a far, you know, the old language is enemy, or there's a near and a far obstacle. So I want to be compassionate, but that can, on one end, move into apathy to protect myself, and on the other end, it can move into attachment. You know, like I want to save this person. So, on the effort issue, there is, quote, right or skillful effort, and we simply mean the amount of effort needed to maintain the activity in an unselfconscious way. You know, like I'm not trying to meditate. I'm meditating. I'm trying to walk. I'm walking. On the one end, there's just too much effort where you're bearing down. And as you move in on that spectrum towards too much, it becomes more and more difficult. Because the more effort that you use, the less sensitivity you're bringing to the experience. And then over on the other end is that, you know, it really starts working, it just feels effortless and what have you, and I'm sure everybody's had the experience either in walking meditation or sitting meditation, that it seems like everything is just going perfectly. Right? I mean, your mind's so bright, and you know, it's like, geez, I'm seeing everything, and then all of a sudden, like, what happened? You know, it's like, I'm just kind of like in a fog, or I'm a little bit dazed, or and all of that clarity and everything that was there is gone. And the reason that happens is that because it seems so effortless to the mind, that you unconsciously start backing off on effort, and then there's not enough effort to maintain the mindfulness and attention. So there's always this, and we can pick any single practice tool, topic, and there will always be this spectrum and this tension. And that's the reason that we talk about like moment-to-moment awareness. Because there is that tension, and it's moment to moment, and it's contingent on the conditions that are present. So if we don't maintain enough effort, our mind becomes dull and unclear. If we use too much effort, our mind becomes contracted, and it eventually becomes resistant. So this is a big issue. And I mean, I know I find myself, particularly like when I'm tired or in early walking periods on a retreat, that my walking tends to be very self-conscious. Because I can tell that my attention's weak, my mindfulness isn't very strong, and so I'm trying to up the effort, to really, really step and see the stepping and all of that. And I mean, you have to do a certain amount of that. That's not to say that that's not good practice. You've got to ramp up the effort to get to the place where it's starting to be less and less effortful. I particularly see it in my walking meditation, this spectrum, and sometimes just catch myself where I'm just kind of rotely walking. So it's very clear I'm not very mindful. So, yes.
So I'm trying to do a little bit of a reboot from Zen training,
mm-hmm.
and I remember doing walking meditations, but nobody really talked about it. You just got up and followed what the other people in front of you were doing.
Right.
What I tried to do today is to come out of sitting meditation and just not lose that state.
Gotcha.
And so turn off the voice, be very much internal, and then get up and move while maintaining that. So I actually didn't do walking meditation in the way that I would have done with the Zendo before. I actually went over mindfully, got a cup of tea, mindfully walked out with a cup of tea, in some cases stood mindfully with a cup of tea, drank with a cup, but I tried very much to stay in that state, and I think it was pretty much there.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments? I mean, is that the bond? Am I getting a bond again?
Your description would be the description of good practice. Yeah, because if you think about it, what we're trying to do is we're trying to practice mindfulness. We're not trying to make artificial distinctions of like, well, now I'm practicing mindful meditation, and now I'm practicing mindful walking. Right? Like the old thing about the amazing thing about my master is that when he walks, he just walks. When he eats, he just eats. So these distinctions in good practice, and particularly in retreat practice, what you're shooting for is that there is no distinction. Your mind is not setting it up that way. So what you describe is, I think, what we're actually all shooting for, to have this continuity of attention and mindfulness in a particular way.
Yeah, one other thing, just because it seems to me there's not much point in doing in just meditating if you can't. I'm kind of, if you can't eventually, this is what I'm working on, get to the point where you're meditating all the time, even as you talk to people, even as you drive your car, even as you do everything.
Yeah.
You're staying in that quiet state.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think I'd word it maybe just a little bit differently, and I would say we're at least from kind of the tradition that I'm coming in. What we understand the Buddha to be saying is that we're trying to develop a continuity of mindfulness, and the goal would be is to be mindful all the time, because. Being mindful, sitting on a cushion or a bench, and being mindful driving a car, they certainly have this base similarity, but their depth is totally different, right? I mean, the depth at which we can see when we're driving a car.
Well, when it's harder than
it. Yeah, you know.
To do it.
So it's just a kind of a difference of application and form, but the underlying thing, the thing itself, which of course is not a thing, it's a process, and you know even that language could be problematic. But mindfulness is a moment-to-moment contingent experience. You know, it depends on a whole set of things, and we're trying to train our minds where we can have those conditions present as much as possible. And if we can, then we can actually open to the experiences that are unfolding, whether they're in the car or in the tea room or on the cushion, rather than the experience that we hope is there or want to be there or are trying to create.
Thank you.
Yeah. I was having a discussion with someone yesterday about this, and you know, we can all repeat all these things about practice. One of the many definitions of mindfulness is moment to moment, or present moment, or here and now, non-judgmental awareness, which is kind of quantumist. And it's like, oh yeah, sure, I get that, you know. And then you say, well, okay, well, let's think of it this way. Suffering is not an affliction. It's actually the thing. It's the integral part of life that the Buddha first saw and generated this whole thing we're doing. And then you can just hear the mind go, well, yeah, but I don't know that I'm really that interested in moment-to-moment awareness of suffering. You know, I mean, like, what I want to really be is comfortable. I actually want to use all these techniques to get away from suffering, as opposed to go through it and get on the other side, right? And there's no question about it that a lot of these practice tools can be very, very powerful in managing suffering, and that is actually an important role, no question about it, and a legitimate role. But the end game, I think the mistake is that you see a lot of people thinking that is the goal. But getting comfortable is the goal, and that's not the goal. It's like getting comfortable enough where then you can go to the next step where you can take on some form or level of suffering that you couldn't before, because you now have this comfort level of confidence that I can handle certain things that I couldn't handle before. So now I can up my game. But if we forget that in the end, that's really the, you know, that's the gold standard, then we have really left something out of our practice. Okay, so any other thoughts about this trying to walk or trying to practice or being busy practicing as opposed to just doing it?
I think it was a really interesting exercise, because I had such different experiences in two walking periods, and I've had kind of scattered the things that I haven't been very collected. And I had, in the first sitting period when I was lying, which I'm not used to doing, I was pretty sleepy and really having trouble. And so the first walking period, going outside and really being very busy, you know, every really focusing on noting as minutely as I was able to do, was helpful in that moment. And by the end of it, I mean, it really did help me collect my attention to create a level of ability to sustain this focus that I hadn't been able to do before. And then the second sitting period was much better. And then when bringing up this idea of contrasting these two different approaches, I was able to really go back in the second period and draw back a little bit, and still be quite present. So So, but seeing the contrast and thinking about the contrast was pretty helpful.
Yeah. You know, you hear a lot about doing and being, you know, is kind of a dichotomy in practice that, well, I just want to be, as opposed to doing. And I think that language can be a little confusing or misleading, because what we're actually talking about is, and your description, I think, is a good description, is that, you know, there's a lot of intentional things that we're, intentional effort that we're trying to do to set up the conditions where our mind can concentrate itself. And then that is a precondition to being able to opening up to the experiences that are unfolding. If the mind doesn't have at least a baseline level of stability and concentration, then it can't do that. So this of making an effort to rather precisely narrow the attention and to hold the attention and to sustain it in a narrower way is part of what brings all of the energies in the mind and the body together. It starts to collect them, it starts to stabilize them, and then calms them. So, and then, kind of like as you described, you know, your mind gets to a certain place, and then you can pull back on the reins and open up. So once again, it's a spectrum. You know, in any given day, you're probably doing a lot of that. You know, maybe not that extreme, but you're tightening up and then opening and tightening up and opening and tightening up and opening as a way of modulating your effort so that you have this level of balance so that you can practice well. You know, once again, it's all mindfulness, all attention, actually all experience is momentary and contingent on the experiences that immediately precede it, the conditions, so that if we forget that, then we can't do this kind of work. Okay, well, like, well, what's going on? I mean, like, geez, I feel really dull, you know. Well, okay, I mean, we feel dull for a reason. It just doesn't magically appear. It appears because of a set of conditions. And so what do I need to do to brighten my mind up? Right? So there's a set of conditions and things that I can do to bring my energy up and brighten my mind up, right? So this kind of a healthy vigilance in terms of watching the experience, you know, the mindfulness has a quality which I think is a little, maybe it's just the way that we talk about it, but mindfulness is purposeful. We're not just, quote, seeing the experience, that, you know, we're understanding it and its implications in relation to suffering and happiness. So, you know, mindfulness sees clearly that the mind has become dull and recognizes the implication that the conditions have changed and that the conditions have to change in a particular way for that dullness to change. So, okay, anything else on the walking or in general about over-efforting or doing versus being? Okay, so was just the reflecting on it helpful? I mean, that's a little different, right? Yeah, it's that's certainly my experience as well. And it's not to say, well, every time you have a walking or a sitting period, you should do a reflection. But it brings home the point that this quality of mindfulness of actually knowing the experience that you're having is the key element. Because, you know, you can have a sitting that's very comfortable and you just feel great after it's over. And you can ask yourself the question, well, what happened during that sitting? And you don't have a clue. or you don't have a clue, you're just lost in kind of sensory experience. There was no knowing. Okay? So if you pull the knowing element out of mindfulness, the mindfulness is not there. You may have this really nice awareness of sensory experience, but that's not mindfulness. So that knowing element, like I actually know what I'm experiencing, is fundamental. And that's where we talk about insight. You know, in our tradition, insight and wisdom / are the same thing. And they're spontaneous. It's not the result of intellectual activity. You have a framework, but then you have this experience beyond words, and you have a spontaneous intuition, understanding that presents itself. And it's of the kind that you know it to be true. You know, it's not like, well, gee, you know, that's fascinating. I'll need to think about it. That's not insight. Insight is, it appears, and when it appears, you know it is true. That's one of the qualities of insight, wisdom. So this knowing quality is one of the key elements in mindfulness that leads to insight. If you take the knowing quality out, insight is not going to arise. Okay.
So, Dennis, yeah. Quick follow-up on that. So, description covers everything. In general, would you say that knowing is nonverbal? That is to say, cannot or is not readily put in, is not commonly put into language?
In the city. Applying it specifically to insight, yes. Yeah, it is a nonverbal recognition that we eventually put into words or concepts. But the experience itself is not like I'm thinking things through when I arrive at a conclusion.
I'm just trying to get a better sense about the knowing part. In sitting, in daily sitting, there are little knowings or little insights, not a lot of profound experience for me, but there are little knowings or little insights for me. But I'm just trying to get a better sense of the quality of knowing, because this is a sensory, including a thought process or ideas sometimes, or a visual stimulus sometimes, or whatever it may be. But so there's a lot of input, sensory input, but most of which does not, you know, result in any idea or anything. Mm-hmm. It's noted, if you will, and then back to the breath and continue with the awareness. So I'm trying to get a better sense of the knowing part of it and how to be more clear about what that is.
Okay. So, I was talking about it specifically in respect to insight. So let me broaden it out just a little bit, and then see if this is helpful. Okay. There's knowing in the sense that we talk about know that it's a long breath or a short breath, or that it's smooth or that it's rough. Or that I'm having a sensation in my leg and there's heat associated with it. And that is a kind of knowing that arises from discernment. You know, we're getting to the point where we can discern different experiences. So that's one kind of knowing. It's the knowing of the experience itself, which is really critical, okay? Because like when I work with students, it's not uncommon to ask about their last sitting and say, describe your last sitting for me. And they can't do it at this level. Okay? So that's one kind of knowing. There's then knowing and kind of insight at a conventional level, meaning at the level of personal relationship, my personal narrative, my personal story, and you know, you're in meditation and things come up, and you, you know, you're not even thinking about it, and some realization just presents itself about a situation in your life. Okay? And when it does, you just know that's true. I mean, you don't have to think about it. So that would be insight on a conventional level. But the characteristic of it is that you know, you're sitting there just paying attention to your breath and your thoughts and your emotions, and it presents itself spontaneously, right? It's the product of this full body, mind-body experience that's taking place. That's the kind of miraculous thing about it. Okay? And then there's knowing in the sense of these more dramatic, larger insights, which are basically all non-personal, having to do with the nature of experience itself. Okay. It isn't so tied to a personal narrative. You know, it's about qualities of mind and qualities of experience. It could be about resistance.
Resistance.
Sorry. Yeah, the consequences of resistance. you know, depending on the context that we drop it into, it can mean different things. But this baseline idea of, like, when we are sitting in meditation or walking, that we actually know what we're experiencing is a fundamental skill set, and one that I think many, many people don't understand and go right by, you know, and that we don't spend enough time in instruction to emphasize this. Well, I just gave three examples. Okay, I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Errors things is right here. I just can't hear you.
You said the last part of what you said, when you're in your mind, and I get really confused when I'm sitting. My mind is. It's just races. I mean, it just amazes me. Every once in a while, it slows down, and I can focus on something. But there, at least my mind has many, many thoughts. And it's sometimes I feel like I'm on a freeway, and these are cars. These thoughts are cars. And so. What I try to do is go back to the breath and focus on the breath in and the breath out. The breath in and the breath out. I just have a very difficult time being able to see what's going on. This is hard to explain. It's just difficult to sit for me. I do fine when I'm outside. I can watch my mind when I'm outside. I have experiences when I'm there. And I don't know why it's so much more difficult sitting.
Okay, so is there a question in there?
Well, there started to be. And I couldn't formulate it. I can't formulate it.
Okay, it's okay. We'll just let it sit. Maybe it will, you know. But, you know, you know, kind of the ground rule is anything I say during sessions like this, you know, aren't personal. You know, I'm trying to come from a dharmic place and talk about process. And I've heard you say this for years, this same report, okay? And so one thing that you might consider, you know, some of us have these really active minds, and I think, I'm not sure if it was when Annie asked a question, I had said that in Asia, you know, people will come and talk to a teacher, and they won't enroll them. They will not take them on as a meditation student, because they can just see that their minds are so active. And some of us have those minds, and it takes a long time to get them to calm down. So, you know, you might consider that, you know, there are a whole series of sitting practices that are designed to concentrate the mind, where you're doing something that's visual or more heart-based. And you might look into those and try that for a while. Because what I'm always looking for with somebody is how do we get a foothold in whatever it is, okay? And it's clear that you're still having some trouble, right? Getting a real foothold in sitting meditation. And so what are the conditions that we create to help that happen? So one of them might be is exploring some of these other techniques. Yeah.
I found that guided meditation early on for me was helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to see that I could sit for more than 5 minutes, you know, that I could actually feel it in my body, that I could go to for 15 minutes.
Yep.
And that seemed to support that effort, and just kept me connected to this opening up to the meditative process.
Yeah.
That's what I found to be helpful.
Thank you. I think that's it's interesting. Sometimes, you know, even experienced practitioners. I mean, why do we go on these residential retreats? And every morning, what's the instruction? It's like, okay. Pay attention to your breath, and here's how you do it. Okay, next morning. Okay. Pay attention to your body. Here's how we do it. You know? And the reason we do that is that there are so many obstacles for most of us by the time we get to this, to meditation, that our minds have developed all of these deep, deep habits of distraction and not paying attention or paying attention in unskillful ways. And so how many people here have ever had the experience where you'll hear somebody say something and then you're responsive? I've heard that 100 times, but I actually heard it tonight or today, you know, right? We've all had this experience. And it's a truthful experience. And it's because of what I just said, you know. So going back, I think intuitively, you're kind of doing the same thing, you know, like... sometimes I will listen to guided meditation series of other teachers, and they're pretty basic, but because they're coming in at just a slightly different trajectory, you know, it's like, oh boy, you know, like that piece I'm not emphasizing anymore, you know, in my own practice or in my teaching, and I ought to be, right? So it can be really, really valuable. Okay, so then the first reflection had to do with the sitting meditation, and this one I always find kind of interesting, you know, like actually trying to look at your sitting practice, and the question was, well, what role, and normally I say if any, but I didn't say that because sometimes it's not, but what role or roles are attention and mindfulness playing in a sitting, okay? So... What happened with that? What did you learn anything about that particular sitting or what you're doing in meditation?
I knew what the subject was, obviously, because I made special arrangements to be here today. It interests me greatly, but I really started thinking about this a lot this morning when I backed my car up my garage. Same house, same garage for 4 years, and almost hit somebody in a very quiet neighborhood where, why was this person walking anyway? By me at that moment.
Yeah, what's the matter with that person?
But as I drove off, I was thinking, I wasn't paying attention. Yeah. Oh, we're going to be talking about that today. So I was driving along, and you're going off into a zone, and I was thinking, attention. That means I would have been doing things in a specific way that would have led to being safer. I was doing all of these things that are automatic, but apparently I missed something. And driving down 50, which requires a different kind of attention,
mm-hmm.
and it's not meditation. But I had one of these things where I thought it's the effort that I'm not going to know the language for how to describe this.
It's okay.
But it's the effort and the action that you are using to develop attention that leads to some kind of mindfulness. And if you don't have that, the mindfulness part is difficult to find. just paying attention and walking. I had a great time. I walk in my neighborhood every morning. Haven't been run over yet. But I walk quickly. And this walking today, I found, as you said, a bit, or somebody said, it sort of felt artificial to slow down. But once I got past that and I slowed down, then I saw I saw things that I wouldn't have seen had I been at my fast pace. So there's something going on there.
Yeah. Well. You know, attention in the sense of a directive and focusing skill of the mind, you know, pointing awareness into a particular topic, experience, event at a particular level, right? And so Jay Krishnamurti, you know, who's just this unbelievable and fantastic teacher, said necessarily that when you focus your attention on one thing, you're excluding something. Okay, so you know you're thinking about coming over here on a particular topic, and that focus, right, has dampened down the concern and awareness about other things. You know that somebody may be, you know, in your driveway walking. And then kind of the amazing thing about this practice is that we, as Kathy was talking about, you know, we narrow it down to concentrate the mind, and then we open up, and then with the mindfulness, and we'll talk about what that means in just a minute, you know, things open up rather than be restricted. You know, there's this initial focusing in a particular way, and then once the conditions are present there, that level of focus and directiveness can be released partially or totally, and then the mind just opens up, and then that's the experience of it. I'm suddenly seeing and feeling and experiencing things, and I have sensitivities that I normally don't have, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I can feel things, I can hear things, I can see things that I normally can't do. So did that, in terms of that one sitting, though, do you have any thoughts about how attention and mindfulness was or was not present, or what role they played in your sitting?
Yeah, there seemed to be I seemed to be sharper in seeing or feeling, you know, using all the senses.
Okay.
Which Rich had taught us in the beginning class a long time ago, being open to all of these things, and what I found was I would stop and reflect and try to listen carefully and try to see carefully and, you know, all of these things. And I stopped at one point and I thought how all thinking, you know, this all happened so quickly, and thinking that walking on the earth is such a solid feel, except one of my feet, both ankles were crooked, and one foot was turned over just a bit enough to cause a little pain. And I thought, all quickly, this is a nice lush green patch of grass I stopped on here. It should have been smooth, but in fact it was very tough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just like life itself. Life is, you know, it may look fine, but things happen. And that all happened really quickly, and I don't think that would have been might have, but probably wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
These different things that were going on during the walk.
Sure.
And there was a little shower of pollen that came from the magnolia tree. And I thought, you know, stop, look up. Where's the pollen coming from? And there's one beautiful magnolia on the tree. One. Now, where the pollen came from, I don't know. But just seeing these things with clarity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What I noticed was the attention is what I used to be to gain the state of mind. Mindfulness is a state, right? The attention is the tool to gain that state. And if I was trying to focus the attention too hard, then there's no mindfulness because there's nothing to be mindful of because, you know what I'm trying to say, that nothing was arising or I wasn't noticing it arise because I was focusing the attention too hard on exactly what happened. So it was that, like, that right effort that you were talking about earlier. If I use the attention as a tool, but then it kind of became the hindrance if I
put too much effort into it.
Yeah, put too much effort into this.
Then it's always stimulates my mind, and I talk too much. I'm sorry, but I found this to be a very worthwhile experience, and I can't say that what I sort of picked up is even remotely. I don't know, I don't want to use the word correct, but this was how I kind of took it. A couple of things that came up in my thought of attention just now when the word attention came. Well, earlier I was imagining the military folks that stand in attention over the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and then I just before thought of the attention that you see in a deer or in some animals where there's this presence and attention. What felt really true for me was that attention would be brought to bring this container back to presence and back to mindfulness. That attention was a bit of a catalyst to mindfulness. It doesn't have the scope. It doesn't have sensorially the mindfulness. I mean, there are the six senses, you know, and so mindfulness addresses them, and also in the I like to study. So Satipatthana Sutta, you know, when you study the body and you study you're aware of the body, you're aware of the feelings, you're aware of the mind, and then you're aware of the dhammas. When that is not attention. Attention is much smaller, at least from, you know, or it's much less this large capacity that we have to widen into. And so that was my sense of attention. Not versus mindfulness, but that there's a distinction between the two.
Okay. Yeah, so did everybody hear what she said? Yeah. Well, they understood it. there was a lot there. But the, attention focuses awareness in, right? It can narrow it, bring it up, what have you.
And then there's awareness and presence. Those would be, you know, that's all in this little mix too. I don't want to go there though.
Okay. And it's important to realize that while we kind of use mindfulness in this generic sense of, well, we're mindful and we experience everything, in quotes, right? I mean, isn't that it? I mean, like, once it's continuous, I mean, like, everything we do, right? But going back to this idea of purposefulness, okay. One of the purposes of mindfulness is not just to be lost in sensory experience.
Sure.
Right? I mean, like, you know, we could walk around all day and just be euphoric in sensory experience, I'm making a separate point, but I'm bouncing off of what you said, okay? So I'm not criticizing anything that you said. But, so, the purpose of mindfulness is there are these areas that the Buddha laid out, these very broad areas, to help us see, first of all, the nature of experience itself in those areas. What is the actual nature of the experience that arises in the body? How does that happen? Okay. There are experiences in the mind. How do those experiences arise? Right? What are they? And then, what is the relationship between this arising and suffering or happiness? Okay. So see, if you take out that part, what is the relationship to suffering and happiness? You've got something really going on, but it's not mindfulness. Because mindfulness arises out of the first noble truth, that the way that we tend to live generates suffering. You know, it's easy to forget that the Buddha's entire system is based on looking at how we suffer and how we get out of suffering. So there's these large areas and then within them. So when we have something, or when we have resistance arise during a sitting to something, okay, being able to recognize not just that it's resistance, discerning that it's resistance, but that that's causing the mind to struggle, it's causing the mind to suffer, is the key element. If you're just lost in the resistance, okay, then you're not accomplishing much. But if I can see that I'm resistance and I can take it apart, this is what resistance feels like in my body, in my mind. And then I can see that when those elements are happening, I suffer. Then we're really getting someplace. Because in the Satipatthana Sutra that you referred to, the sutta on the four foundations or the four elements of mindfulness, the Buddha, you've heard me say this before, talks about these three questions. And after each one of these areas, and I think it's repeated something like 17, 18 times in the sutta, the Buddha says, when you do this meditation or this mindfulness practice with respect to the body, you should be asking yourself, what causes that to arise? What causes it to be sustained? What causes it to diminish? Okay. So it's all about this coming together of elements, because from a Buddhist perspective, everything is about a coming together. When things come together, when conditions come together, certain things arise. You know, sadness, happiness, lust, confusion, resistance, openness, kindness, sadness. It's all the product of conditions coming together. Something arises, and then when those conditions start to change, there's another coming together. That's a different experience. And when those dissipate, then that's another experience. Sadness isn't there anymore. Happiness isn't there anymore. So it's all momentary, things coming together, and it's all contingent. It's contingent on these conditions being there in that way. And when they're not, the experience changes. So every single experience, from a Buddhist perspective, is coming together and contingent on the elements that are there. And once those change, so all of this training is about how do we develop qualities of mind to deeper maintain the conditions that support kindness, compassion, equanimity, generosity, all those things, you know, point the mind that way, and diminish the conditions that point the mind in the other way. That's what all the training is about. And to be present to seeing that. No, to knowing, the conditions that are there are going to point your mind in one way or the other. And the reason attention is so important, and both attention and mindfulness being continuous, is that if it's not continuous, we can't see it, right? If like 40% of our experience we're missing simply because we can't hold our attention and our mindfulness in it, just because the mind's being so distracted, think about that, the implications of that. It's unbelievable. I mean, like, we're already behind the ball. Like, those are bad odds. But I mean, we know that that's the case, you know, and probably much higher than that. You know, like when you first start practicing, you know, you say, God, I can't believe my mind. I can't stop thinking, you know. I can't believe all the garbage that keeps coming in here, right? And this is the reason that we de-emphasize, not that we eliminate or discount it, but we de-emphasize content in this practice. Because there's all kinds of ways to deal with the story of your life. You know, there's terrific therapeutic process and everything else. But here, the power of seeing that everything is contingent and momentary, and focusing on that, is that it depersonalizes everything. Because you realize that all this stuff that's hanging you up about the past is actually in the past. The reason it's screwing you up right now is because momentarily the conditions have come together, and what's appeared? A memory that you're attached to and don't want to let go of, or you can't let go of, you think. And now I'm suffering because of that memory. And this is what, you know, we call deep habits of mind. This is what a mental formation is in terms of this process of awareness. So we have these deep, deep, deep habits of mind. And given the right stimulus, the right trigger, the right condition, that memory, which is, you can think of like, here's this little storehouse over here. And it's a storehouse of all the things that you don't want to think about, and all your bad habits, okay? The very, very deep habits of mind. You're sitting along, you know, you're just having a great time, right? Like, everything's perfect, you know? And then somebody says something. And then what happens? You know, like, this thing that's over here instantaneously just rushes in. You know, it's kind of like it explodes in your face. You know, I thought I was so happy a minute ago, and now I'm really pissed off, or I'm sad, or I'm something. Okay. So that's the coming together and the arising, right? So the stronger that we develop a mind where our attention points into the coming together and the arising, and the mindfulness looks at it from the perspective of Buddhist causation, the less personal it becomes. It may still be awfully painful, but slowly you start to, you know, you have this attack, you know, of emotion or whatever it is, and there's a piece of you that just says, okay, I just got to put up with this. But it's like it's not me. I mean, it's terrible. You know, my mind wants to define it as terrible. It feels terrible. But this thing about now I have to start beating myself up, or I have to start feeling shameful about it, that all starts to go away. That gets all dampened down, and then you really start making some progress with it. Because the whole purpose of the practice is to disassociate everything that's over in this storehouse with a sense that that is actually some permanent you. It's a very deep habit of mind that arises and causes you to suffer given the right conditions. And the reason you know it's not me is that when those conditions aren't present, you don't feel that way. Right? You know, I always have this amazing and disappointing experience where I talked a little bit about it the other night, but I have this assumption that I've come up with. I think it's right, you know, but I could be wrong, but I'm holding on to it pretty strongly that with my grandson, it really helps him if I can get him to events early. And if he can be there and, you know, see the other children that he knows, you know, and he can warm up a little bit and everything, that's the condition that allows him to perform better, whether perform means, you know, just be able to do a group activity with less stress, or you know, throw a baseball, whatever it is. And then the other night it happened again. You know, I get him all ready and we get ready to go, and I put him in his safety seat in the back of the car, and I take off, and the traffic is insane. I mean, it is just obscene. And immediately, I am so pissed off, I can't believe it. And it's a level of being pissed off that I'm normally not used to. And I'm pretty clear that the reason I'm so pissed off is I feel that now I'm not going to get him there, and that's hurting him, right? So it has this enormous charge on it. Well, the moment before, we were having the greatest time, right? And now I'm like completely pissed off and suffering. So you can just see so clearly, you know, if you can bring even a little bit of mindfulness to it, that it's because of the conditions, right? These conditions have arisen. You know, they're momentary. They're contingent on the conditions. And one of the conditions is my being attached to this notion that if I don't get there at a certain amount of time, it's going to be hard for him, and then I'm going to be, well, I got to let that go. And if I don't let that go, not only am I going to continue to be pissed off, when I get there, I'm going to be pissed off. I'm not going to be able to participate. I'm not going to be able to support him. He's going to have a bad time. I'm going to have a bad time, right? So it's that in that moment of this, whatever it is that's over in this little storehouse someplace inside of our body or our mind that's come up, that mindfulness saves us and sees that and sees the intensity of it and says, hey, it should be like alarms and bells should be going. It's like, hey, what are the conditions? Hey, look at that. You know, don't start obsessing about you're late and it's going to hurt him. Once we let go of the process, from a Buddhist perspective, once we let go of that focus, what has come together and caused it to arise, and why is it contingent? The minute we let that go, what do we have left? We have one thing left: content. It's all over. It's all over at that point, because the content is then generates just generation and generation of emotion and thought, which generates further emotion and body tension. It just keeps going. Okay. Is this working? Right. This is the core. This is the underpinning. You can take any teaching of the historical Buddha, and this is what lies right below it. So, to the degree that we can start practicing more this way. And you can see it applies to daily life. That's the reason I use that. It's not just walking meditation, sitting meditation. It's your point of being mindful. Okay? It's like, there it is. You know, like, fortunately, I woke up to that. Now, being totally honest, in behalf of self-disclosure, I didn't just instantaneously become equanimous. But by the time I got over to where we were going, I had calmed down and I was fine, you know, and I was able to be there with them and was able to let go of that quite quickly. 20 years ago, 25 years ago, that would not have happened. I would have been upset the entire night. I wouldn't have been able to let go. So just that, and then our own life starts to become, you know, the workshop. You can see from your own life, if you practice long enough, that what may be possible. I mean, like, if that's possible, it took 25 years. I don't think I've got another 25 years. But if that may be possible, who knows what may be possible? I think that what may be possible for all of us is so much greater than what our little shriveled up idea of what may be possible for us. I really believe that with this practice. You know. Okay. So I think what we'll do is break for a walking period and come back and sit a little bit, and then I'm going to give a real abbreviated talk, which I hope is going to kind of synthesize or summarize these in a way that what we've been talking that may be helpful.